This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a doctor says there's a me versus us divide when it comes to health in the United States, and that more emphasis on public health can be good for all of us. Now, if you've tuned into American politics lately, you probably know our civil discourse can feel kind of uncivil. Our next guests say we need to change that, and we can. They're holding conversations with academics, journalists, political leaders, and members of the public to figure out ways to bring back civil discourse across party lines. That's all part of a UW-Madison conference called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin, Fulfilling the Legacy of Bill Krause. It starts at 9 tomorrow morning at Gordon Commons on UW-Madison's campus. It's open to the public, and you can stream it live on Zoom. You can find info at WPR.org/centraltime. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the way we talk about politics change? What would it take to change it for the better? Have you had experiences in your own life talking to people with different political beliefs? Have you stopped talking to friends, family, coworkers because of political differences? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's affiliated with the Department of Political Science and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's a faculty affiliate at the Elections Research Center. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here, Rob.
And Louis Friedland is a professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's with the Department of Sociology, and he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. Lou, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Rob. Good to see you.
I want to start by talking about Bill Krause, the inspiration for this conference. I've interviewed him. I used to book him on talk shows all the time. When I saw his name, I think I get what this conference is about. Mike, can you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Bill Krause was a person who helped make careers of Republican politicians in Wisconsin in the 1970s and 80s. He was, you know, a person kind of responsible for running the Dreyfus campaign for Governor Dreyfus. He also was really important in negotiating and making the UW system happen in getting the landmark 1982, I think, gay rights bill passed in Wisconsin. And the reason he was able to do those things was kind of the reason we want to have this conference. He was very well known for talking across party lines. He was a partisan Republican who worked with Democrats, who trusted that you could have conversations with people who you disagreed with to find common ground to achieve something. And after he stopped his work in kind of, you know, political life when it came to working in government, then he ran Common Cause in Wisconsin for a few decades, the watchdog group which monitors government spending and how government uses its power. And so he's a person who is universally respected amongst Republicans and Democrats in our state, and his orientation towards civility, compromise, trust, building trust across lines of difference are the sort of things we want to highlight and have a conversation about with our guests and folks who want to come to Gordon Commons tomorrow at 9. We'll be there 9 to 5, open to the public.
And Lou, do you want to jump on that point there? Learning from Bill Krause, taking those lessons this conference tomorrow and trying to recreate that concept of, hey, we can talk to each other.
Right. I think that's – Bill Krause really did represent the ability to talk to each other. It's really in some ways that simple. He was also an incredibly nice guy. I used to appear on him on the old weekend show on Wisconsin Public Television some years ago. And Bill, first of all, he knew almost everything about Wisconsin politics. There literally wasn't a topic that he couldn't talk about knowledgeably off the top of his head. And he was just such a nice person.
Now, Mike, actually you've been part of a team doing research on how we talk about politics, the media we watch, things like that. And the concept of, hey, this guy's a Republican, but he worked with Democrats. He talked to Democrats. He got along with Democrats. Seems like a quaint throwback to a different era. What kind of things are you looking for these days in your research about how we've moved away from that?
Well, we see at the legislative level in our state that there's not a lot of conversation across party lines, at least that takes place publicly, that's very positive. There's a lot of gridlock. There's a lot of the governor, say, calling a special session and the legislature, you know, the other party gaveling in and gaveling out. And so we see lots of those kinds of things, or the legislature passing a high number of bills and the governor vetoing them. And so there's not a lot of conversation across party lines that seems very productive amongst our elites. But we also see that conversation And then the conversations that happen on social media, talk radio, and the news around that is bleeding into our own regular daily lives in Wisconsin. And so things we've discovered in our own research show that more than 6 in 10 Wisconsinites say that they've stopped talking about politics to somebody because they disagree. Most of those are they put in the family and friend category. So it's not that they go to work and agree just to talk about the Badgers or the Packers. It's family and friends that they're stopping talking politics with. And 1 in 5 say that they've just outright ended a familial relationship or friendship because of these disagreements. And that's just not common in our relatively recent history in our state. We've been able to talk across party lines. People like Bill Krause did that very productively, and we're seeing less and less of that as partisan animus, contentious politics, misinformation, all these sorts of things bubble up and make it much more difficult to have productive conversations across party lines.
And Lou, I could see this being a downward spiral. If we're talking to each other less, we're going to know each other less, we're going to like each other less, we're going to talk less. What are the prospects for turning that around?
I'm not sure. That's a good question, Rob. And I think the question is, are there places where we can have civil conversations? Where are the spaces where people will talk to each other across different lines of disagreement? You know, WPR is one of those places where people do manage to have that public conversation. But what we need to have, and encouraging them is difficult, there's more conversations in the networks and the social spaces that people actually live in. Just like people are separating in those spaces, we need to figure out ways that they can begin to talk to each other again. They may not agree. In fact, chances are very good that they won't agree on many things, but to at least be able to listen to someone.
And there's nothing, Mike, in principle wrong with people disagreeing. I mean, our country was designed to have disagreeing parties come together and agree, you know, or compromise at least somewhere along the way. How do we get back to civil disagreement, though?
I think one thing has to do with people being willing to accept the idea that when somebody disagrees with them, it doesn't automatically mean that that person's values and value are suspect. People might highlight different values in their own individual lives, and they might apply those to the things they would like to see happen politically. And it's not necessarily that people are nefarious or have ill intent with views they have that are different than our own. And so when I talk to people about engaging in conversation across party lines or talking with the family around, say, the Thanksgiving dinner table about misinformation when people are sharing things that aren't true, I would say aim for the heart and not the head, right? If facts worked, we wouldn't need to do more than present facts to people. But part of this is that we have to trust each other well enough and be willing to listen to each other to say, you have a different view than me. Why don't you tell me about that, rather than me saying to myself, well, when he's done talking, I will let him know why I am right, which is just a less productive way to engage in conversation about really tough matters that we ask our elected officials to help resolve for us.
Talking to Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. They are organizers of a big conference tomorrow aimed at helping restore civic conversations about politics, civil conversations about politics here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Brookfield. John, hi.
Hey, how you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Yeah, I work for a trucking company, and I am one of four of about 130 truck drivers that are a Democrat. When we come in the morning, we wait for our loads in a driver's room, and all you hear is complaining back and forth between the Republican people and the Democratic people. And it's just, I'm almost to the point where I want to quit the job. I've been there 10 years. I love the job, but it's like everything's so volatile now because of what if you're a Democrat or Republican, it's horrible.
Do you are there things you could talk to your colleagues about, John? Is sports a safe topic, or just down?
No, well, we have a TV in there, and there's sports on all the time, and for some reason it turns into politics.
Huh. Interesting. John, thanks a lot for sharing that story. John's not alone. A lot of people, I think, Lou, find themselves in workplaces, in families, whatever, where they're the odd. I've talked to listeners who say, I'm in my community, I'm the odd one out.
Yeah, in workplaces in particular, Rob, there's good research that shows that actually that's where there are lines of difference, because people generally aren't screened for their politics before they get a job, whatever it might be. And yet, so you have more heterogeneous or different kinds of people in the same room in a workplace. And that means, of course, that there's more likely to be some disagreement. And then how that gets processed is it's a tricky subject, right? Because if you're working alongside someone, you want to get along with them. You probably don't want to be engaged in conflict. But if they've pressed your political hot button, it's very hard. You know, people stop sitting there having that fluid conversation and start to wait, as Mike said, to jump in on the conversation. And then a vicious spiral gets set off.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Denny in Ogdensburg. Denny, hi.
Hi, I've taken a different tack. When I'm a political animal, I study these things, and I ask people just to tell me when they want to talk, what are the four or five most important things to them? And I just listen until they're done talking, and they generally say, what's important to you? And I respond generally by acknowledging that whatever they had on their list is important to me, but it may not be the most important thing. And what stuns me is what Winston Churchill said, you want to find the biggest problem with democracy, spend 5 minutes talking to the average voter. It stuns me how few people know the difference between a deficit and a debt or the CO2 level or the cost of health care. They just get tied up in the minutiae, but by me letting them talk about what's important to them, then acknowledging that and taking it from there, it's worked for me.
Denny, thanks a lot for sharing that. Mike, I've talked to people who talk about how to talk through conflict, and they say, don't start with the controversy. Start with values, and you're probably going to find some shared values like Denny says he did.
I think that's right, and our own work bears that out a bit as we look at people who have conversations across lines of difference and can do so in ways that aren't bringing up the tension are also people who tend to be more moderate in their politics. They tend to split their tickets more when they vote. And so people who are, you know, exposed in these situations, both like your first caller was talking about and then like Denny was talking about, there are elements of it that are uncomfortable, right? But there are also benefits because you get to learn about what the other side thinks. And sometimes that can actually have a moderating influence on our own views to say, oh, you know, these people aren't, you know, they don't have the negative traits that my preferred news sources tell me the other side has. These are people I can see living and breathing right in front of me. And when we have those kinds of interactions, they can help to moderate us. They don't always, right? Sometimes people are going to push our buttons and as Denny says, if it's something I really care about, I'm probably not open to changing my opinion about it as compared to an issue where I don't think about it as much. And so it's very complicated, which is why it's such a hard set of problems to solve.
Thanks for that call, Denny. We're talking to Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, here to talk about a conference they're hosting tomorrow called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin. Find info about how to participate in person or online at WPR.org/Central Time, and you can call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think we can do to change the way we talk with each other about politics, especially when we disagree? Has it been an impossible dream for you and your family or your workplace to have a civil conversation about political issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. With us today to talk about a conference they're hosting tomorrow about restoring civic life and civil conversation here in Wisconsin. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Elise in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Elise?
Excellent. Well, you know, what you were talking about, you know, the system being designed to handle disagreements and such like, and to some extent it was, and to some extent it wasn't, right? You know, the system was definitely designed to accommodate differences of opinion on, you know, whether or not to go to war with France, but on whether or not to, you know, curtail slavery, whether or not to limit the power of the wealthy. Those are things that our Constitution was not really designed to allow. And when people did start having disagreements, it did end in bloodshed. And I'm very much of the belief that it couldn't have gone any other way. And now, you know, to use a more modern example, you know, so the idea is that, you know, with this golden age where people would sit down and talk and come to compromises, had a lot of assumptions about who was making the compromises on behalf of whom. In my personal case, you know, I'm a trans woman. And, you know, and of course there's all this talk about when someone gets to know a member of a community that's being questioned, right? Then of course they'll be more receptive. Well, you know, my biological father, who I'd, you know, known since birth, when I came out, he forbade the entire family to have anything to do with me, to have any contact with me. My grandmother's sick right now, and I'm actually asking to be allowed to visit her in the hospital. But, you know, and, you know, he'd voted Democrat every time in his life, but I believe he's voted Republican ever since then. I don't know. He hasn't spoken to me for 6 years.
I'm sorry to hear that, Elise. Best on dealing with that family situation. But Elise makes an interesting point. Lou, we sometimes think of a golden age where people got together and, you know, compromised, but it might have been a small elite subset, and a lot of people weren't at the table in the first place.
Well, certainly there was a period, there have been recurring periods in American life where large groups of people were excluded from the table, and worse, were persecuted, as Elise's story invokes. And that's part of our history. There's no question about that. And some of that is conflict. And, of course, the Civil War and then the Jim Crow that followed was the largest simmering, ongoing, still ongoing conflict in American life. So no, it wasn't a simple case of we used to have a golden age and now it's declined. That said, there have been also cyclical periods when people could work out differences. Civil society ebbs and flows. In the pre-Civil War period, it was obviously coming apart, and the Civil War was the result of that coming apart. In the post-war period, despite continuing racism and sexism, there was also a way that people could resolve disagreements institutionally. Unions, for example, made a huge difference in bringing people together across race and gender lines to some extent, and allowing people to say we have some common views and common interests. So institutions do matter. Institutions have fault lines, and when those fault lines start to split apart, then conflict in everyday civil life also becomes more exacerbated.
Elise, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about civil society and civil political communication in Wisconsin with Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner from UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, we hear a lot about the places where we're divided. You know, we maybe watch different media outlets. We do different things. In your research, have you found remaining at least vestiges of places where people from different backgrounds, different opinions can interact in a positive or at least neutral way?
There are a few political issues even where there's broad agreement across party lines, and one of which is a really hot button one in Wisconsin that WPR News did a great podcast about. I'm looking at redistricting. And in Wisconsin, in our survey, majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents support a nonpartisan redistricting commission. And this is especially remarkable because the Republicans in our sample who say we would prefer a nonpartisan commission recognize that they're the beneficiaries of the current system in terms of how redistricting works in Wisconsin. So there are issues where citizens across party lines recognize issues of basic fairness and how those things might manifest themselves from a policy point of view.
Lou, I wanted to ask you about the media in all of this. That covers a lot of ground. There's some media outlets who exist to exacerbate, I think, these differences. For those who aren't doing that, though, are there things you think that we could be doing to help provide forums for civil communication?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes in Wisconsin's always had historically a very healthy newspaper industry. Every town of any size, 5,000-10,000, had a daily newspaper that covered the ongoing affairs of that community. As we all know who've been following this, and I think most listeners do too, those newspapers have shrunk. They've been consolidated into ever larger sets of corporations. And their budgets have shrunk, and so they cover the community less and less. That was a space of common conversation. The media, particularly newspapers, and then print and television and radio tend to follow the newspapers for news. That was a space where a kind of implicitly civil conversation took place. As that's declined, there's less and less common space. And one of the things that's filled that void in Wisconsin is particularly, frankly, conservative talk radio.
Mike, the conference tomorrow, I know you've been living and breathing it for a while now. What are you hoping comes out of this event?
Well, we're hoping that we can have conversations about strategies to have productive conversation across lines of difference. We also want to tell the truth about what we know empirically about the state of democracy, the state of civil society in Wisconsin. We want to hear perspectives from journalists, so we'll have a more academic panel at about 10:15. We'll hear from journalists at 1:15. We'll have a keynote from Tommy Thompson, former governor, at 4 o'clock. All of this in Gordon Commons on campus, all open to the public. What we're hoping to get out of it is beginnings of conversations. Let's start conversations about things we might be able to agree on. Let's start conversations at least that establish that we want to keep having conversations about hard issues, which is something that, we ought to be able to do in a state like ours, where people are deeply informed as compared to folks in other states. They are more participatory as compared to folks in other states. And so we ought to be able to find ways to continue having hard conversations across party lines where we've been lagging behind other states in recent years.
We'll leave it there. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
And Lou, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Been talking to Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're both professors in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. With us today to talk about this conference they are hosting tomorrow. It's called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin, Fulfilling the Legacy of Bill Kraus. The conference, as you heard, goes from 9 to 5 tomorrow at Gordon Commons on UW-Madison's campus. It's open to the public, and you could stream it live on Zoom. We've got conference information, details on how to connect via Zoom at wpr.org/centraltime. Find a link there. Check it out. Let us know if you appreciate what came out of it. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, cryptocurrencies have dropped in value a lot over the course of this year, and one of the stars of the industry is in the midst of a total collapse. Find out what's happening in the strange and often inscrutable world of blockchains and electronic coins. Join in with your questions and maybe your experiences if you listened to the Super Bowl ads and tried investing in alternative currencies yourself. That conversation's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We are a week out from Thanksgiving, and there's a good chance you're coming up with plans for food, whether you're hosting or bringing a dish to pass. Turkey always gets a lot of the attention, the dessert too, but what about the unsung heroes, the side dishes? A new non-scientific analysis from the food wholesaler Food Service Direct rates the top side dishes around the country and by state. They use data from their own sales and internet searches for recipes. Here's the top five nationwide. I'm counting down here. 5, sweet potato casserole. Number 4, cranberry sauce. 3, green bean casserole. 2, mashed potatoes. Number 1, macaroni and cheese. I don't think of mac and cheese as a Thanksgiving side, but there it is. Here in Wisconsin, the number 1 side, according to the report, is the classic green bean casserole. You know, the one with the crispy fried onions in a jar that only exist, I think, to put on this casserole. One question I have, where's the stuffing? Food news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, actor Hugh Bonneville has won dozens of awards. His face has global recognition thanks to his starring role on Downton Abbey. The Earl of Grantham joins the show today at 6 on 1A+. Now, when you think about your health, you might think of individual choices and treatments, your diet and exercise habits, prescriptions and procedures when you get sick, the stuff you talk to your doctor about. But there's another side to health, public health, the things that can affect huge numbers of people, whether that's air and water quality, access to preventive care, affordable and healthy food, or warning systems to help spot the spread of new infectious diseases. Our next guest is a doctor working with individual patients, but he sees a big problem. An overwhelming share of health spending in the U.S. goes to individual health, not as much goes to public health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How often do you think about the concept of public health? Do you think we need wider interventions, changes to help stop problems before they cause that visit to the doctor's office? Did COVID-19 change the way you think about the way we think about health in the United States? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Michael Stein is professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's the author of over a dozen books and executive editor of Public Health Post. His newest book is called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. Dr. Stein, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Last time I talked to you, we were talking about your book where you talk to your patients about their money and their struggles in some cases with money and how that affected their health. Can you talk about that and what started you down this road of thinking more about public health more generally?
Yeah, I'm a primary care doctor. I see people one by one in my office. I'm also a researcher and I moved recently to a public health school and began to think about things outside of my office and the larger world, right? So I grew up and was taught in my medical training and also just as growing up in the United States that we have powerful ideas about individualism and we think of our lives as individual journeys, we make our own career success and failure and we're self-absorbed in the pursuit of happiness. And so that of course leads to the optimization of health. And so we believe that we're responsible for and can change our health. We can eat better, we can sleep more, we can exercise, and that's what I call the me part of this story. Well, the public health asks something very different of us, right? It asks us to think of others. It asks us to think of us. It asks us to think of America as a group project where the benefits might not come to us immediately or specifically, but rather to all of us, including our kids and our grandkids. So public health really is a different framework of thinking about the world. And that's what I've been writing about recently.
And in the book, you look at the investment in the me side of things, you know, the healthcare versus the us side of things, the public health. Can you lay out which side of the seesaw is getting pressed into the dirt?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So the truth is that in the United States, we spend $3 to $4 trillion a year on healthcare, medical care, that is going to our doctors, emergency rooms, into the hospital, getting CAT scans, getting blood tests, paying for our medications. That's healthcare. We're very familiar with it. When you talk to somebody at a barbecue or at Thanksgiving dinner and say, tell me about your health, I imagine within 15 seconds, they'll be talking about their doctor. That's not what public health is. It is larger things that we're going to talk about. But what we know is that per American per year, we spend $11,000 on healthcare. And per American per year, we spend $280 on public health. So 40 times less on public health than we do on healthcare. And there are lots of reasons for that. But because we spend less money on it, we take it less seriously, we know less about it. And that's a problem. I believe that that's a deep, deep problem for Americans and for our kids and grandkids to come.
Now, if it was working great, that might not be a problem. What do we find when we compare the healthcare outcomes or the health outcomes here in the U.S. versus comparable income countries?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. Thank you. The idea of life expectancy is one we could all understand. We think of it as sort of a population of people, maybe in our family, maybe in our neighborhood, maybe in our town or state. Certainly as a country, we understand what life expectancy is. We expect to live a certain number of years as a group. The other way to think about it is, you know, what are my chances of living to the age of 70? That's how another way we think about life expectancy. Now, I consider life expectancy a beautiful metric of public health. It is sort of a group metric. And what we know is that in the 1990s, the average life expectancy in the United States was about the same as anywhere in developed countries in Europe, Germany, Norway, Spain, England. We were about the same. And now we are considerably worse than all of Europe. We're about 40th in the world in life expectancy at this point, even though we like to think of Americans as exceptional. We're 40th, which means that, you know, an American baby born today is more likely to die before they turn 5, and an American teenager today is more likely to die before they turn 20, and an American adult is more likely to die before they turn 70 than any place in Europe. That is, Europe has better life outcomes than us across the board. That's for whites and blacks in high poverty areas and low poverty areas. That's a shocking statistic if you really believe that America is exceptional, and I think it's unacceptable.
Talking to Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. We're talking about his new book. It's called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Malik is with us in Green Bay. Malik, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I'm curious, the impacts to public health and even public health initiatives, if something like universal health care were to ever pass, how things like that might change, from an initiative standpoint.
Malik, thanks for the call. Dr. Stein, universal health care as a way, at least, to address health care access.
Yeah, Malik, thanks for the question. The universal health care, I would consider in health insurance or access to care, which comes through insurance in the United States, as a part of public health. I would consider it a small part of public health. It is an important part of public health. And I think a real moral question for the United States, why we have 10% of our population who is uninsured, hesitant to get care, likely to be bankrupted if they actually have a medical event. Those are sort of moral and important access questions. In terms of whether our life expectancy would change if those 10% of people had health care, is probably a small amount. I don't think that that's what's driving our low life expectancy in the United States, but I do think it's an important political question, something that I believe in entirely, that everybody should have a right to health care. And an important thing to bring up, but not central to public health. Mm-hmm. Again, health care distinguished from public health.
Malik, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Stein, can you give an example where you think an investment in public health could really help us tackle a particular problem, one of those things that really is bringing our life expectancy, holding it back?
Yeah, so let's talk about, let's choose one of our big ongoing problems, which I would say is overweight or obesity. So obesity has gotten worse in the past 50 years in the United States, right? So this notion of the me view of the world, right, which is maximize my health, maximize self-interest, and that will produce a better future for all of us, hasn't really worked out. And the paradigm case for that is obesity. So we spend billions of dollars on diet books. We enroll in diet programs. We now have medications for obesity. We do surgery for obesity. We've tried lots of medical things, and yet we're worse off than we were 50 years ago, such that nearly half of our population is obese, which, as you know, drives diabetes and heart disease and therefore premature death. Well, why is that? Is it because really 50% of our population just has no willpower and are just weak people who in the individual view of the world are unsuccessful? I don't think so. I don't think that that's how we're ever going to get out of the obesity problem. The problem of obesity, even for people who are dieting, is that we all live in a world where food and food systems are dictated by large companies that call the production, the processing, the distribution, the preparation, and the consumption of food in America. And those systems are shaped by social and cultural systems that we live in, and do things like have policies such as corn and sugar subsidies. And when you have corn and sugar subsidies in your country, you have the cheapest food having corn and sugar in it, which is high calorie food, which is why when we go to the supermarket, we're deluged with difficulties in keeping to a diet. So all of this is a long way of saying that the world that we live in, the policies that we've allowed to drive our food systems, is what's driving obesity. And that's not an individual decision. It is at the end of the road, but it's really hard. And so if you want a good public health, then you want to set up a system of the world, of the economic and social and cultural world, such that it's easy for people to maintain their health. And with food, we've done exactly the opposite, and we're in trouble because of that. And that trouble will only be solved by large policies, I believe, and many of them. There's no single simple answer to obesity in America, but I believe it's driven by policies. And I keep using that word policies because when you're dealing with populations, as we talk about in public health, policies matter.
We're talking about public health and individual health care in the U.S. Our guest is Dr. Michael Stein from Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, if you think that there is a public health intervention that you'd like to see that you think could make a big difference, maybe something you've seen in your own community, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. He says too much of our spending is going toward individual health care, not enough toward public health, things that could prevent a lot of those trips maybe to the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Ruth is with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yes, hi. Public health is a lot about preventing illness and individual illness and broader group illness. When you're dealing with prevention, you're in a world where you have to be able to prove or talk about how certain things didn't happen because you put things into place. So more people didn't get ill because you put masks on, for example, or some other intervention. How do you see, Dr. Stein, how do you see getting that concept out into the public to be broader understood?
Great question. Dr. Stein.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Public health is about prevention. It's one of the three P's that I've talked about for what is public health, right? Which is prevention across an entire population. The second P is that population. And the third P is policies. And you're talking really about sort of messaging. Like, how do we prove to people that we've had a benefit? And it's a great question. And the answer is maybe it's around things like coming up with analogies. So let's think about sort of the general public good. We believe in the public good in certain parts of our lives, like fire departments, right? We have fire departments that are we pay for through our taxes in most cases, in most towns, and we believe in fire departments, and we want fire departments to take care of us when things arise. And we want fire departments to limit the amount of problems when they notice a problem. And fires don't go away. If you shut your fire department down, you wouldn't get rid of fires. You would just have bigger fires. So fire departments are important because they let us have a public good that we've invested in. But in addition to that, we have over the years invested in fire prevention, right? We have better wiring. We have different materials for our houses. So we do a variety of things that say, well, we're going to keep fires down through the materials that we use, and we're going to keep a public service up through a fire department. And we have to do the same thing around public health. We have to think of it as a fire department defending a public good that has elements of prevention and elements of surveillance and elements of early intervention. And all of those things are done by our public health departments. And we need to understand what our public health departments do, which I don't think we do in the United States very well, because we have a confusing public health system, and we need to sort of be aware of that.
Talking to Dr. Michael Stein about his new book, Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Andrew on the line now in Heartland. Andrew, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I had a quick question for Dr. Stein. I'm a neurosurgeon, and we've been seeing more and more young kids dying from heroin overdose here in Waukesha. I think our last numbers are about 11 a month, which is really scary. I think there is an epidemic of drugs, and I agree with him 100% in that this is all about policy, and I think we've been very lame in regards to tightening our belts and trying to make better policy regarding illegal drugs. And what I'm seeing more and more is us liberating this, specifically now with marijuana, that all we know as of now is a way to introduce the young population into drugs and into stronger drugs. I mean, my stand on it is very simple. I would say absolutely no illegal drugs, and that includes marijuana. But from the policy point of view, Dr. Stein, what would you suggest we do? How do we tackle?
Andrew, thanks for the call. Dr. Stein, what would be your a public health approach to especially the drugs that are causing those overdoses?
Yeah, so if you look again at life expectancy in the United States, what you see is we have lost 2.5 years of life expectancy in the last 3 years. That is a historical record for us going backward. It's just terrible news. And part of the contribution to that is the growth of drugs. We have 100,000 people dying of opioid overdoses in the United States per year at this point, the highest ever. We also have more than 100,000 people dying every year of a legal drug called alcohol in America. And we have another 100,000 dying of cigarettes, nicotine, another legal drug in the United States. So there's a combination of what I would call avoidable mortality by coming up with policies, and they're complicated. They're not simple, that will try to minimize deaths from these particular causes in the United States, along with gun violence and accidents. These are the reasons why our life expectancy has dropped and was dropping even before COVID, clearly made worse by COVID. So these are complicated policies, but it's not just about opioids and prescription drugs. It's really about alcohol and cigarettes as well still.
Andrew, thanks for that call. Dr. Stein, you also write in the book that there's not always a financial incentive to take a public health approach. I could write a diet book. I probably won't, but I could potentially make a lot of money for me by doing that. Advocating for a public health change to tackle obesity, there's not really a strong profit motive. How much of an obstacle is that?
Obstacle, right? When we get the private sector involved in any part of our society, things move faster. We're an innovative country, and the question is how to do that in the public health arena, which is a product that ends up being very local. So it's hard to make money when you have hundreds of public health departments, because as you know, Rob, in the United States, we have city health departments and county health departments and state health departments, and we don't have a federal health department. And so to how to make money across all of those health departments, which are typically government entities interested in large communities, there's not a clear way to do that. There are some investment vehicles now that are bringing private equity into public health in small ways. It hasn't really caught on yet in the United States. It may well in certain ways, but in general, public health, because it deals with large swaths of the population, becomes a government project. And that's right. And that is the way it will be done in the United States over the next decade. But we're also, of course, at a time when we distrust government, and our government moves slowly, certainly at the federal level, at the state level as well. So it's hard to, again, engage at full speed here at a moment where we distrust and feel divided. So it's a tough way, and I don't think that our private sector is going to bail us out of this one.
Dr. Stein, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. He talked with us today about his new book. It's called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided, looking at investment in and lack of investment in, he says, public health here in the United States. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll answer a Wisconsin question about the state's 1849 abortion law, which is now back in effect, and look back at the politics and culture of the time that led to that law being passed in the first place. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some great recipes for pasta dishes, some simple, some fancy, all delicious. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.